Welcome to the Edu All-Stars Podcast.
Hey guys, welcome to our ninth episode of Edu All-Stars. I am super excited because today we have with us Angela Myers, who is the founder and president of Myers Education Services, a consulting firm out of Clive, Iowa. She provides consultation services to schools, organizations, and individuals seeking to use technology and social media. She's also a pioneer in the You Matter movement and has two amazing books called Classroom Habitudes and The Passion-Driven Classroom. I'm one of your hosts today. I'm Todd Nesloney. On Twitter, I'm Tech Ninja Todd.
And my name is Chris Kessler. You can find me on Twitter at I Am Kessler.
And we promise that Stacy is still part of our podcast team. But today she is enjoying her last vacation before she has to head back to work on Monday. So we wish her all the best from the lake. And then, like I said, with us today, we have Angela. So, Angela, you want to just say your name and your Twitter handle for us?
Yeah, Angela Myers. It's at Angela, A-N-G-E-L-A, Myers, M-A-I-E-R-S, all one word.
Awesome. Okay, so we'll just go ahead and jump right in. So the first thing we always like to ask our guests is just a little bit of background of how they got into education. So what was it that pushed you into that field?
I think teaching has been in my DNA ever since I can remember. I actually took a little alternative track because I was also very passionate about learning and very passionate about how the brain actually learns. And so I pursued a career in science and neuroscience. And just a few weeks before medical school, to put myself through college, I was working four jobs, and they happened to all be with children in some capacity. And my professor slash boss came in and said, "What are you doing?" And I'm like, "I'm studying." And he said, "You know, do you really want to be a doctor?" And I was like, "Oh, I never really thought about it." He's like, "I just saw it as just passionate learning." And he's like, "What are you doing? We're going to get you. You need to be a teacher. So we're going to make that happen." And so I went home and told my whole family, "I'm quitting school and I'm not going to be a doctor and I'm going back to school. I'm going to be a teacher." And I thought everyone would be so happy for me. And no one was. They're like, "What are you doing?" And at that moment, I actually really define sort of the foundation of what I've been studying and talking about is what passion is. And passion isn't doing what you want to do or like to do. That's a hobby. And passion's not even doing what you're good at doing, because I was good at doing science and mathematics and I was good at learning. Passion is doing what you must do. And the moment where deciding that this is what I was born to do, what I must do, if somebody asked me not to teach, it'd be asking me to not breathe, you know. So I don't have a choice. Teaching is in my DNA. It's in my blood. And I don't regret one second of choosing this amazing profession.
So you kind of hinted on this a little bit already, but is there one particular influence that kind of steered you toward education, maybe a former teacher or something along those lines?
Well, absolutely. That conversation with my college professor was a turning point. It was the first time somebody really asked me what matters to me. It was on this sort of pursuit, and it's helped me define the difference between pursuing success and pursuing significance. Because I was, to all accounts, successful at that time. I won't tell you how long ago it was. It was pretty rare for a woman. I was the first woman in my family, first, you know, child in my family to go to college, the first woman in my family to get a degree, and very few women were accepted into medical school at that time. So from that perspective, from society's perspective, I was successful but not fulfilled. And what fulfilled me the most in my days and nights was working with these amazing students, these children, these families. Most of them were in situations that most of us could not bear. And what I learned from them every single interaction, I'm like, I need to be a part of this process.
We should also note that out of the eight, or I guess this is the ninth podcast, you're the second Iowan that's been on. We had Jimmy Casas
really?
On also. So
who did you have on?
Jimmy Casas.
Oh, he is so awesome.
Yeah,
he's awesome.
I love Jimmy.
They must be doing something right in Iowa up there.
Yeah, growing good in Iowa.
Good.
And you know, it's funny because my family is from Iowa. And so
really?
my grandparents grew up there, and my great grandparents lived there. My great aunt and uncle live there still. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, my family's there too.
you know, this is the heartland. They call that, it's for a reason. Yeah, passion it starts here, so.
Well, I know that right now you're no longer in the classroom on a campus, but you aren't necessarily removed from the Edusphere. So can you talk a little bit about your transition from leaving maybe the educational field into kind of what you're doing now and kind of how that happened?
I think my entire career has just been a transitioning of different classrooms, that all of it has been about teaching. So I've been in the physical classroom starting at preschool. I taught every grade all the way to eighth grade, and then I did a liaison position between my school and the university that I taught at, and I worked with undergraduates for 7 years that were moving into student teaching and wanted careers as teachers and help mentor them into the school system. And then I taught graduate school for about 12 years. So I've never stopped teaching. It's just my classrooms have moved. And so moving to the web was just an opportunity to open up and have a different kind of student. So it still is teaching. It's still education. It's still teaching and learning. It's just my students, if you will, or my co-learners are different sizes and shapes. So it's not been any different than moving through the continuum of starting as a kindergarten teacher and then, you know, ending up as an eighth grade teacher or a college teacher. The principles of what makes a good teacher and what makes learning happen are exactly the same. I used to say to my university students, the only difference, I would read aloud to them every class, like exactly how I did in my kindergartens. We start every class with a read aloud. And the only difference is they didn't rub your nylons while you were reading aloud. They sat there and said, you know, like, oh, this is so awesome. And then they just don't, you know, kindergarten kids will come up and they'll just rub your nylons and they'll just, like, hang on to you. But that's the only difference, is just a few of those little protocols. But learning is learning, and learners need the same thing. And teachers that are great no matter who their audience is. So
I love that.
So you're a very connected influence on Twitter. You have, like, almost 100,000 followers, I think. And so how has social media played a part in your career?
Life-changing, learning-changing, game-changing, life-changing on so many levels. For me personally, it's an extension of who I am as a writer and who I am as a learner, and that's how I entered the space of social media. My background's literacy and linguistics, and when I speak about literacy, I don't speak about literacy as reading and writing. I speak about literacy as power and privilege, and so literacy, as it evolved in my own life as a reader or writer, evolved when I started blogging. I can't believe it's probably been six years at least, that I started my own personal blog. And in the same sort of road to discovery, whether you're writing a book or you're writing a blog or you're taking notes on note cards everywhere, being a writer is something that is life work. It isn't desk work. And so blogging became an integrated part of my life as a reflective tool, as a learning tool, as a leadership tool. I didn't realize there was a whole dynamic community around the web, and that the more I started understanding the ecosystem and the infrastructure of the web, the more I understood this was as like offline as online. There was no such difference as this is real life or in real life. Like, I'm going to meet you in real life as if this isn't real life. And the moment you started acting like it was real life, that these are human beings and that these are a chance to make your room bigger and to learn more and to bring in individuals in a room that you would never ever be able to sit in a room with, is game changing personally. So just a very personal story. I just got off the phone. One of my partners, because of social media, is a group of the world's leaders. They are 4-star generals, 5-star generals, Medal of Honor winners. So the general that just took over command in Afghanistan, I just got off FaceTime with him, and we're working on a dual project together. Like, where would you be able to sit in a room with a 4-star general and to learn together as co-learners? Where would a school teacher and a soldier be able to help change the world together?
Exactly.
That's social media, power and privilege beyond belief, and that's open and accessible to all of our students when we stop talking about social media and media, we start talking about how we need each other as human beings and how we have to depend on each other and how we have to help each other and how we are smarter together. And that's what social media is.
Well, you know, one of the other things that we've talked about with several of our guests on the show before is how some of our us that are connected educators, some of our best friends are people that we met through an online avenue like Twitter, people that we would have never met in real life from different states or different parts of the world. Do you find that true for you as well?
Absolutely. And it's really funny because you start adopting what I call a global learner mindset. So I was doing an interview with a non-education group, and somebody said, like, you know, tell me about Iowa, or said something like, tell me where in Iowa. So I started explaining the geography of the United States. I'm like, well, it's in the middle of the United States. And they're like, no, I'm so used to orienting myself, understanding that I don't even sometimes know where I'm at because I am in a global community of learners, and my colleagues are, I've been collaborating with them for 3, 4, 5 years, and then you're actually with them face-to-face, and sometimes it hits you, and you're like, oh, my God, we've never actually met face-to-face. I can't believe we've been working together for 3 years, and we've never met because it's so, and I think technologies like this are game-changing. Google Plus is game-changing for that reason. It's very different than hearing their voice. It's very different than a Google Doc. It's having video makes it a lot more intimate and a lot more, I think, transparent. And so absolutely the core, I would say the core of the people who influence and lead my life are individuals I met online.
So cool. Well, one of the things we love talking about on our podcast is people's passions. And I know you deal a lot with that. And so we're going to jump right into the passion portion. And so many of us are told that rigor is the foundation of a great classroom. What do you think, what role does passion play within the classroom?
Oh, is that a trick question for me? You're asking to talk about passion. So before we talk about passion, I want to define passion. So, and more importantly, define what passion is not. And it speaks to what I said earlier, that passion isn't what you like to do. That's a hobby. Passion is not what you're good at doing. That could possibly be a job or a career. Passion is what you are called to do. It's what you know you are essential and needed for. And it pushes you to a level of rigor and to a level of vigor and to a level of commitment that not any other single thing could do. So the root word of passion is to suffer. And so if you look at what people are willing to suffer for, and suffer could be physical, it could be emotional. If you look at anything significant that's been accomplished since the beginning of time, the foundation of all of that, the possibility of all that, was built on passion. People were willing to suffer for their mission, suffer for their cause, and there's attributes of that. That cause or that mission or that work is almost always something bigger than themselves, and that the drive is about essentialness and about significance. It's not about personal success. So within that, there's significant attributes of empathy and humility, and that you are working for and in service of others, and passion is what sustains you. And passion, again, the litmus test when I share with kids, do I know if I'm following my passion or do I know if I'm moving towards it, is can if blank was out of your life or if you weren't doing blank, could you imagine your life? And almost anybody that's embroiled in passion-driven work or passion-driven art or passion-driven service, the thought of taking that aspect away from their life, asking me not to teach, asking a dancer not to dance, asking a writer not to write, is akin to asking them not to breathe. And so when you know it's that level of your DNA, that it is a commitment that you can't get from an outside source. It's an inside-out phenomenon. So
one of the things that I've seen, this is a trend happening right now across the country, is genius hour in people's classrooms. And what do you think, first of all, what do you think about genius hour, and how do you think that impacts the students and their learning?
So I first wrote about genius hour in the passion-driven classroom because there is passion exists. It needs to be noticed, it needs to be nurtured, and it needs to be sustained. So you need a framework to sort of liberate the genius ability of and the energy of passionate people, passionate employees, passionate students, passionate leaders. And so when you look at organizations that do a really good job of that, Google is an organization, FedEx is an organization, 3M is an organization, and they put 20% of time to give people a chance to pursue things that matter to them. And the caveat on top of all of that is it can't just simply matter to you, that pursuing that has to benefit someone other than you. It has to benefit your company. It has to benefit your classroom. It has to benefit the greater world. And that's actually the driver of passion. So I wrote about what that structure would be if we gave 1 hour a week. And then somewhere through other books and other people talking about it, it just started noting the concept of genius hour. So I'm absolutely very committed and very conscious of the role genius hour plays. And I've been really lucky to be very connected to the group of leaders and teachers that are changing instruction, changing lives and learning through genius hour. So one of the parts of the movement that I'm about, Choose to Matter, we've been working with the genius hour classrooms and genius hour teachers in what we call the quest to matter. So as these students pursue things that matter and pursue it with the mindset and the insight of making a contribution that's going to impact the world, we've been taking their projects and taking their ideas and connecting them with real-world leaders and real-world individuals. And we have over 474 projects that kids have done to change the world. And so we have picked the two sort of drivers of the movement is the ability to recognize that the only people that underestimate a kid's contribution and underestimate the role passion plays in somebody's work and effort is school. That the world demands passion. That is the one differentiator, that's the one differentiating factor. If I have a worker that's passionate, if I have an employee that's passionate, I've got somebody who is fiercely driven, I've got somebody who is empirically creative, I've got somebody who is committed beyond anything that I could ask them to commit to, and I've got somebody that is literally confidently unstoppable, because the idea of quitting is non-existent. The idea of quitting your art or quitting the work that you're doing, it's not even in the cards. It's frustrating and you're going to fall down, but you're not going to quit. There's nothing that you're unstoppable. So those are the qualities that Genius Hour builds. It builds commitment and it builds habitudes and it builds muscles. And I think what we've noticed is the bigger driver, rather than asking kids to pursue what matters to them, to pursue their passion, we've actually been helping them pursue compassion-based learning, which is to pursue heartbreak. So instead of saying follow your heart, we've been asking kids to follow their heartbreak. So the driving question of the quest to matter was, what breaks your heart about the world, and what are you going to do, and what are the people around you going to do passionately to fix it? And so these kids have tackled everything, and I'll send you the link of the projects that they've tackled, everything from human trafficking to sexual assault to abuse to schizophrenia to suicide to teen violence to, there is not one cause in the world that they have not tackled head on. And my job is to connect and leverage the connective genius of our kids with the individuals and enterprises in the world that can actually scale what they're doing. And that's what Choose to has been about.
I love that. And now when you talk about these submissions by classrooms or students, do you see that a majority, like a lot of people who aren't in the educational field will say, well, they're just kids, they can't do this or do that. Do you see some of even the younger students submitting Quest to Matter projects?
So here's what's interesting. That is the belief that we would get that. The world, the business world, the entrepreneur world, the enterprise world, one of the partners of Choose to Matter is one of the most elite innovation networks on the web. There's about 5,000 of the world's top storytellers, disruptors. It's called the Business Innovation Factory. So their elite membership is about 400 leaders. This is the CEO of Zappos, the CEO of eBay, the CEO of Craigslist, the CEO of pretty much every disruptive industry that you have. That's the group we've been working with. Not one single enterprise, not one single business, not one single organization that we've worked with ever questioned the genius of our kids and ever questioned the legitimacy of their contribution. The only trouble that we've had with Choose to Matter is schools and teachers and leaders believing that their kids have actual impact in the world. And they create projects with tokenism that might bring an adult to sort of like judge a project and say, oh, that's a really cute thing, but they've never invited them to legitimately co-solution the problems in the world. And that's what Choose to Matter does. Innovation is not an event. It's an invitation and an expectation to contribute your genius. And when you show kids that in the beginning, they're a little doubtful. And so at the end of this year, I got to be with 350 high school kids on the last day of school. So imagine that. said to them, you're a genius and the world needs your contribution. How many of you believe me? Not one kid raised their hand. Like, you're full of shit. I know you think that because you've been told for 12 years that you can't count. You can't lead right now. You can't, you've got to wait till you have this and this. Well, I'm telling you right now, that's crap. So here's the deal. You can go home and have a great summer, or if by 10 o'clock you don't believe that your contribution is going to make an impact, then you've only wasted an hour with me. And they spent 2 solid days, 48 solid hours. We had to get them to eat. We had to get them to go to bed. They launched 14 social enterprises in 2 days. And it was mine. I'll send you the video because they captured it.
Yes, please do.
Video, but the two things when we asked the kids what changed, more than any other programming, more than any other sort of event that they had, they just had a NASA astronaut at their school, and they said, because you believed, legitimately believed, that our impact mattered, and you asked us to contribute solutions to really massive problems, and they did not back down. And I think we don't ask kids to solve wicked hard problems. We don't ask them to do terrifying work. We don't ask them to set audacious goals. We certainly don't ask them to change the world because we think that's cliche. And the challenge is the web is asking exactly that from every citizen. And you cannot do any of that without passion. So it was passion in action, if you will.
That's what really brought me to following you on Twitter, is because I've been one of those teachers who has believed that for a while, but like you said, sometimes I'm surrounded by people who are saying something differently, and to hear you constantly sharing that message from your platform, it's like, God, that inspires me to continually try to find ways to encourage my kids to make a difference in the world around them.
It's so amazing to be in this intersection that I'm at, this intersection of industry and enterprise, the sort of cusp of the evolving web, social entrepreneurialism, leadership, and education, because this is the language. You can't have a conversation in business. You cannot have a conversation in whether it's HR and recruiting or whether it is college or whatever it is without the word passion coming up. And every single time I speak in terms of an educational audience, when you said I have a tough question for you, my toughest questions are coming from educators. These are questions of limitations. Everything is about limitations. We can't do this. We can't do that. Well, we don't have time to be passionate. We don't have time to ask kids what they – well, the bottom line is if you don't secure the heart, you don't have a shot at their brains or their business. It's just that simple.
Exactly.
It's not an emotional thing. This is absolutely economic, and we are losing kids. We are losing our clients, if you will. Even though they might not physically be out, every single human being at the DNA level wants to matter and wants to do work that matters. And we break that promise of authenticity. We break that promise of expectation every single day to them. And that it's just so basic that that's our only job. Mm-hmm. Every day are we giving kids absolute access to skills and strategies that matter and are applicable in the real world? And do we give them a chance to contribute what they're doing with other people? So it's mind-boggling, all this conversation around Common Core and content and all that. Anything that's associated with consumption doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter what you consume, how fast you consume it, how accurate. It matters. You're judged by how your contribution impacts other people. Mm-hmm. You're not judged by what you know. You're judged by who you are. And we're not building character in our kids. And they have amazing character, and they want to change the world. They want to make a difference. And for the first time in human history, they have a chance to. Unfortunately, they just don't have a chance to in school.
So, in some schools, some classrooms.
Yeah, some classrooms. No, that's why I'm so proud of the Genius Hour teacher leaders. And even if it's just 1 hour where they have a chance to make a contribution to impact somebody else, it's absolutely a first start, and it's growing into something pretty massive, and it's very exciting.
Cool. Well, one of the words I heard you mention was habitudes, and I know you have a book titled that as well. Can you tell us a little bit about the book for maybe some people who haven't read it yet or haven't heard of it, and what habitudes is?
So I've been studying the principles of success both at the individual level and organizational level for a long, long time, probably for a decade or more. And when you look at the actual DNA of of success of elite athletes or elite performers, really the principles of performance, elite teams, there is a very identifiable set of attributes that these individuals and organizations embody. And to describe those attributes to kids, because they're not skills, they are much more elusive than skills, I wanted to describe what exactly they were. And they were a balance of both habits, very, very dependable, very decipherable behaviors and dispositions that these individuals and organizations engaged in. They were habitual in their pursuit of excellence. But the key attribute was their mindset, the way they saw their world, the way they saw their role in the world, the way they viewed other people, the way they saw, and it's more than just the glass half empty or the glass half full, these individuals dwell in possibility. They don't spend their time fighting for limitations. So when you narrow those attributes down and you looked at the greatest performances in our history and the greatest contributions in our history in every field, ones that changed our lives and our world, from Edison to Einstein to Steve Jobs to Henry Ford, those were identical. And then we have the internet that gave us the insight, the background into how these individuals became able to make a contribution at that scale. And the first attribute that came up was passion. So explicitly talking about the pain involved in the process. There's not one single individual with talent beyond talent that said, this was a piece of cake for me. You know, Michael Jordan, I just went out and I just, you know, dribbled a couple. They talk about excruciating pain, excruciating emotional pain, excruciating frustration, excruciating defeat. So passion is at the forefront of that conversation. So the pain of excellence is something that there is no like sugarcoating what it takes to be excellent or to make an impact that has the ability to change or disrupt. And then they talked about perseverance. They talked about grit. They talked about imagination and the role of dreaming, seriously articulating and honoring dreams. And they talked about curiosity, their fierce passion for knowledge and their commitment to discovery, not answers. And they talked about self-awareness, the ability of not only how they wanted to position themselves or how they wanted to be looked at, but how others perceive them. And that was really important in their development. They were very, very, Aristotle in the beginning said, your most critical attribute is know thyself, and to be grounded in your values and to never waver on that. So when we put all these lessons together, and then a conversation started emerging with this idea of 21st century skills, because what the workforce is demanding right now is individuals who can make contributions that disrupt an industry, that disrupt a world, that disrupt the status quo. So it became a competitive economic conversation when we started saying, oh my God, we don't need, you know, physical force in our labor force. We have machines to do that. We don't even need a cognitive force of workers and citizens because machines can do that. What we need is individuals willing to contribute emotional labor, willing to create art, willing to deliver products and ideas and visionary, and we don't have those. And what we found is we don't have the habitudes. We're not building the habitudes. And so when you looked at that body, then from the perspective of my perspective, development, early development of learning and early learners, every five-year-old has those attributes at a spot on. So the first large major study in the habitudes was done by NASA. 168,000 five-year-olds were tested in that talent, sort of that talent code or that talent pipeline, whatever you want to call it, 21st century skills, entrepreneur skills, whatever label we put on it. With those actual attributes, 99% of five-year-olds cross demographics, cross socioeconomics have these attributes. They are passionate. They are curious. And so this dialogue is interesting to me when I first started the habitudes in terms of lessons and in terms of schools. The conversation was about and still is about how do we teach these skills? How do we teach entrepreneurs? And you put them in a college class and said, oh, you take this and you're going to be an entrepreneur. How do we teach, you know, creative thinking? It's a bunch of crap. You don't teach it, you keep it. And you absolutely systematize and fiercely commit to the environment that grows these competencies. And they're grown by experience. They're not grown by talking at kids. You don't know what grit is. You don't know what perseverance is until you've had a challenge that forces you to your knees. You don't know what passion is until you've encountered heartbreak, because passion is what gets you past heartbreak. So if we don't give kids real problems, if we don't give them real situations that stop them in their tracks, that stop their heart, that stop their mind, and that make them shake, if you will. You have to be shaken. You have to be shocked. And you have to understand how to build courage to take risks. And none of those are standard in our schools. We don't have environments that invite the habitudes. So your brain, even though it's not a muscle, is a use-it-or-lose-it organism. So if you never practice being courageous, and you never practice dreaming, and you never practice and get the questions that you ask validated, soon you stop asking questions, and you stop dreaming, and you stop thinking big and audaciously, and then you start being a really good student, and you become an A student, and you become a valedictorian, and you get a college degree, and you're nearly not hireable, because no one needs somebody that's smart in that way. So.
Todd, I want to skip down to a question that just kind of segues nicely. So failure is a huge piece of this learning puzzle. So how can educators embrace failure in the classroom? Because it happens every day. How can you embrace that with students, or have students embrace failure?
I think before you ask students to embrace failure, that you have to commit to developing your own habitudes. So the most significant arsenal that we have as teachers, or our most powerful teaching tool, is our ability to model, or to put somebody in front of kids that models the kind of learner, the kind of leader, the kind of performance you're asking them to be. It doesn't matter how young, and we do this in sports very, very well. We don't show a mediocre football player to a football team that we want to light a fire under. We show them what playing a powerful game is all about, and then we break the steps down. So if you think about every single day, do kids get a chance to see teachers taking risks? Do they get a chance to see teachers grappling with problems? Do they get insider information into how problems are solved? So one of the things that I love doing, and I haven't had a school leader brave enough to do it, is when I present these provocative ideas at staff development, or I present these ideas to groups of leaders, I videotape everything that I do. Everything is a game tape now. So we should, like right now, that's why I asked you, are you videotaping? Because what we like to highlight is the end performance. And we don't show them where the real learning is. How did you get to that? We don't show them the sweat. We don't show them the worry. We don't show them the frustration. We don't show them how we, you know, with humility, state our point and disagree with people. So I think that the testament of whether a school is ready for this kind of environment and really ready to prepare the next generation of learners is told at a staff meeting and told at an in-service. And if you videotape the kids, the teachers, learning when they are confronted with problems, when they are confronted with things that they don't agree with, when they're confronted with ideas and things that go against what they're comfortable with, you want to know, how do they react to that? Do they ask more questions, or do they fold their arms? Do they argue, or do they talk behind somebody's back? Do they say, well, I'm going to do that? And so if you have a body of adults that don't act and behave in the way that you're expecting your kids to act and behave, then you have a huge disconnect that is an elephant in the room that nobody talks about. You cannot build kids with the habitudes if you don't have teachers with the habitudes. So what I love about working with learners like you and connected educators is that whether we know it or not, what the web is teaching us, what the web's demanding from us, are our habitudes. It takes courage to put your ideas out there. It takes humility. It takes empathy. It takes extraordinary question asking. It takes absolute adaptability. Every single minute, technology is messing up on me. And I never let it, I mean, if I was striving for perfect, I would get nothing done in the day. So social media, more than anything, has helped build my habitudes. And so every day I have a lesson that I can go stand in kids and say, you know what, you guys, I got to tell you what went wrong yesterday. On this phone call just here, it took us 4 tries to get this live streaming from Afghanistan. I'm going to tell kids, I'm going to say, you know what, yesterday I had a really important call, and here's what happened. So here's what I did differently. And so the next time this happens, what did you notice that I did? Well, you asked questions. Well, you didn't give up. Well, you know, we're patient. Well, you did. All right, excellent. So today in math, if this happens to you, or today in science, if this happens to you, I think it is the elephant in the room that we don't talk about. I don't want my kids' teachers to know everything. I want them to be a learner, and I want them to be teachable, and I want them to model that for my kids, because nobody knows everything. And if they don't have the habitudes, then I don't want that person modeling to my kids what learning and leadership is.
I love that, and I love that you I love that you use yourself as an example with the students as well, saying, here's how I messed up and here's how I handled it. I mean, I think that's a perfect example for kids.
And every day I'm messing up in front of kids and teachers, every day. And you know what? It's so freeing, because it is a huge stress to think that you have to be perfect. It's a huge stress to think that you're in charge of the learning in the room. The smartest person in the room is the room. So you're in charge of creating the conditions that liberate the genius of the room. And so whether I'm giving a keynote to 1,000 people, or I'm working with 100 teachers, or I'm working with 5 kids, my absolute objective is to liberate the genius, to notice and acknowledge who we have in the room, so that any problem that comes up, I can say, we got this. We got this. There's extraordinary confidence from knowing that we got this. It's interesting, because the conversation with the journal this morning, or the general this morning, he was speaking about how the foundation of their training as leaders is to train the wingman, to train every single individual from the 5-star general there to the entry person to be a wingman at any time. Because if you think that the person that's going in to execute it only will have that confidence if they are surrounded on both sides with individuals that have their back, that with individuals that won't let them fail, they will not have the confidence, they will not have, and at any moment you can be called to be a wingman. And I think that's what we are for each other as a connected network. It's not just a personal learning environment, it's a personal empowerment environment. I can be fierce, I can be brave, I can be anything that I would not be able to be on my own, because I have 100 people that will not let me fail, who believe in me, who support me, who will not tolerate if I become apathetic, or I start complaining too much, or I start, you know, whining about this and that. They'll be like, you know, buck it up, get back out there. You know, stop wasting this time with limitations. Back out there and try again. So,
well, you're also the author of the You Matter manifesto and the You Matter hashtag. And I kind of wanted to read the manifesto real quickly, and then after I read it, I'll ask you a question about it. But the manifesto just says, you are enough. You have influence, you are a genius, you have a contribution to make, you have a gift that others need, your actions define your impact, you are the change, you matter. Can you kind of tell us a little bit how that movement got started and kind of where you see it headed now?
Yes, it happened at 3 o'clock in the morning, the night before.
The best ideas do.
The night before I was going to give a TED Talk, and I knew how powerful the brand of TED was. I did not write the presentation with the intention of starting a global movement. I wrote it because I knew that you have 17 minutes to tell the world how you're going to change the world. And one of the things that I noticed in all the extraordinary TED Talks, because I was a TED fanatic, like a freak, is that as excited as I was and inspired as I was when I watched a TED Talk, seconds later I felt deflated. And I felt less than, like, oh, my God, well, I could never do that. I could never, like, you know, figure out how algae is going to save the world. And so I started feeling like I didn't matter, and that who am I to stand up on that stage, and who am I to offer when all these other smart people. And then I was awoken at night, and I would never tolerate kids to think that. And for 25 years, not once would I ever tolerate a kid to say that to me. And my mom has been, since I started teaching, you are a genius and the world needs your contribution. Our class needs your contribution. So I said, well, I need to live up to that same thing. And so I tore up the speech I was going to give, and I did that one just straight from the heart. And my goal was, like, please not fall off the stage. You know, like, show my cute shoes, but don't fall off the stage. And that's about it. And then, you know, it doesn't curate till like 6 to 8 weeks later. And I went and did 20 more speeches. And then it started taking off like crazy, and it started spreading, and I had organizations like NASA scientists and Wall Street executives and really, not education, really competitive industries, high-end industries say, will you come talk to my industry? Will you tell them that they matter. I'm like, what? You make more money than God. Why would it matter? Then I started really digging into my background, which is the science and the neuroscience, and understanding that mattering is not, absolutely not a nicety. It is a necessity at every single level, that we were created for significance. And that all these principles that I sort of naturally used in my teaching, I started understanding the context of them economically, globally, and then that drew me to organizations like the National Guard, like the leaders, because mattering and knowing you matter is a matter of life and death. That if these soldiers don't understand that they matter, if we underestimate those two words, we underestimate human life and human potential. And it was very interesting in the beginning of the movement when You Matter was getting attention, the only pushback I got about the message was from educators. And they were diminishing and marginalizing the message as something inspirational, where the rest of the world was lining up at my doorstep saying, this is imperative, this is critical, there is a reboot and a revolution in the world where we're trying to get back to the core of who we are as human beings, whether it's the humanizing of the web or the humanizing of a brand. And the core of that is that if your workers, if your learners, if your community doesn't believe they are valued and noticed and essential, you don't have any power. You have limited power, and that's very positional, and that can go away. And so then that grew in conjunction. Genius Hour started taking off, and whole schools were studying the passion-driven classroom and that framework, and those two worlds sort of merged. Is this past work doing that I was doing with the Habitudes and with the passion-driven framework, and I started putting the two things together, that our greatest act of mattering is knowing we're essential to someone else. Well, there's no greater motivator than knowing you're essential to the world. So when we started asking kids, you are a genius and the world needs your contribution, and here is all the heartbreak that's happening in the world. There's heartbreak everywhere, and young kids are aware of it. And so we asked them to say, well, what breaks your heart about what you see and what you hear? And what I love immediately after that is, what are we going to do about that? And that's the most beautiful response that you can get as a teacher and as a human being, is when our community starts acting like a we and says, how are we going to use our collective genius, our collective ability, our collective talents, and what are we going to do to create a different world? And the bravest of the projects and the most fierce of the missions that came apart out of the movement were actually kids between the ages of 11 and 13. Yep. And if you look back at the history of genius, that's not surprising at all. Mm-hmm. The people that contributed massive impact to our world knew what their calling was, knew what their passion was, and knew what their passion was, started very, very early records. As early as 3 and 4 years old, Mozart wrote most of his pieces at 6 and 7. Beethoven the same. Einstein talked about the theory of relativity bubbling up, and his commitment to curiosity was at 7 and 8 years old. So we have this untapped genius in our presence that is just waiting to be liberated, and the world absolutely needs their contribution.
Well, so, you know, I love the You Matter movement, and it was something that I discussed quite a bit with my fifth grade students this year. Yeah. And it was so funny because it made such an impact on them that at the end of the year, one of the things they wanted to do was to remind the other people that work at our school that they mattered. And so the kids themselves, my fifth graders, put together this day where all we did, they made a giant banner in the hall, where they just constantly went out there and wrote notes to other people on campus that they had noticed things. Never signed their names because they didn't want any credit. It was funny because my teachers are very sometimes against the social media avenue, but my students aren't. And so like they, when they would sign it, they literally put the hashtag "You Matter," even though they were just writing it on a banner. But they also, they took it one step further and wrote a letter to somebody on campus. It didn't have to be a teacher. It could have been a janitor, a cafeteria worker, somebody on campus that they had noticed something about them and they wanted to remind them they mattered. And then they went and delivered those notes that day. Awesome. And it was such a simple...
You have to send me that. I have to write about that. Oh my gosh, that's so good.
It was so cool. And more so to see the effect that it had on the staff. Because, I mean, especially, I think educators tend to get downtrodden very easily by the system that they're in. And we forget the impact we have because our kids leave us sometimes and we don't see them or see the impact until many years later. And so taking that moment that those kids wanted to recognize all yep. kinds of people on campus, it was powerful. And they would come back to the room after delivering their letter, and they were like, we made her cry. They said, it was just a letter. Why did she cry? I said, guys, I said, you don't realize that as teachers, that's why we are in education.
That's right.
Is to make an impact. And when a kid reminds you of that, it's a powerful thing. And, I mean, we did that probably with 4 or 5 weeks still left in school.
Yep.
And they wanted to write letters every day after that, after they saw the emotional impact. And I told them, I was like, you know, this isn't something that just has to stop here at school. I mean, you can write it to your parents. You can write it to your neighbor down the road. It's just a movement where I think it is so important to teach kids to tell others that they matter.
I was on a webinar, a hangout a couple days ago with Richard Branson, the CEO of Virgin, and he said something really, really important. He said, once you have been a part of a transformative experience, you don't go back. And so that's really what this gives kids a chance to do. When you have made an impact to somebody else, you're not going to go back and say, I want to be insignificant. And so you don't have to bait them, you don't have to hook them, you don't have to have bells and whistles. The deepest motivator for a human being to give everything they are is when another human being says, I needed that, or I needed you, or I couldn't imagine, Todd, doing this without you. That is the greatest motivator at the DNA level that will say, oh my God, I'm needed. It's a survival mechanism. Everyone from Auschwitz survivors in Viktor Frankl's, that he knew that he was needed by someone else. And that's their route to survival. So when you know you're somebody's wingman and you're needed, there's nothing that you won't do to improve what you have to do. That's why I'm fighting this movement. With every obstacle that's come in, I have no staff. I have no money. This is not my job. People are like, oh, is you mad at your job? I'm like, no. And even my family doesn't understand. Why are you doing this? Because I have to. There is asking me to not do this. You're asking me to not breathe. So it's you. When it's needed, you step up and you do whatever it takes, even when you don't think you can do it anymore.
One of the things that I did last year, we did Genius Hour in my class last year, and before I introduce it to the kids, I have a little status update on my door on the outside. Yeah. It's called, instead of Facebook, it's Kessbook. Anyway, the kids read the, you know, I put the quote on there that you're a genius and the world needs your contribution. Oh, yeah. About a week before we actually introduced Genius Hour, and the cool thing about it to me was that probably 95% of those kids, they've never been told they're a genius.
Exactly.
They've never been told that they matter. And they all rose to the occasion when it came to this Genius Hour project. So it was really, really awesome.
You have to send me that. You have to send me a picture of your door.
Yeah, so we'll do. I've got it on my phone.
I can announce it on this show. So one of the things that I've been really passionate about is because I've seen the Genius Hour teachers, they're wingmen for each other. And so we've supported each other and we've moved this forward. People that are saying this is silly and not silly. Now it's a massive group of educators that are bringing legitimacy to this time and really positioning passion in a way that it hasn't been positioned, and it's beyond exciting. What we haven't been able to do is find a space for our kids to do the same for each other. So I'll be introducing a platform that was actually built for us. And that's what's so beautiful about the web, is that you would think I'd have to raise $1 million to build a space for Genius Hour, a space for the movement, and I just have been writing about it, and that's the power of social media. So one of my partners is the Huffington Post, so I've been talking about the movement there, and Top Coder, which is the largest coding network in the globe, it's got 500,000 of the top coders in the world that build platforms like Facebook and the ones that we use, said, we'll build this for you. And wow. So we've been working with two organizations, another organization called Your Sphere, and we are creating the Genius community so that kids can experience what it feels like to be a part of a passion-driven community. And so they'll have spheres of passion. So their sphere might be dancing or photography or whatever, and then we'll have cause spheres, which are the causes that the world needs. So an entire sphere of photographers could join a cause, or the leaders of a cause sphere could go to each of the passion spheres and say, we need a photographer, we need a digital editor, we need a dancer, we need, you know, a singer, come join us for this mission, and it's temporary. And it's all password protected, and kids build their digital identity in it. And I'm so excited to launch the prototype I hope in the next 2 weeks, so that it'll be a space where kids can pursue their passion and can rally a community on the causes that matter to them. And then the game changer for me and for kids in the work this year has been the legitimacy of sharing what they've done in their passion project or their compassion project with legitimate enterprises, businesses, and individuals that can mentor them. So we've set up a whole mentoring network. That's what I was doing all day today, that has the world's most elite leaders, innovators, and disruptors that through social media will be giving advice and insight to the kids, not just to legitimize this is a cute idea, but really significant advice like how do you put a pitch deck together and how do you create a video and how do you find out whether there's other causes or how do you do research or how do you get a trademark or really legitimate things that can help turn and scale their ideas and dreams into legitimate solutions for the world. And so we're trying to get those two things ready for the fall, and I'm really excited.
I'm really excited. That is amazing.
And I love that you're working on building a network for the kids to not only just have their ideas where they can share them, but also take them to the next level.
Yeah. Right. Because an idea that's not shared is just genius lying dormant. You know, like there's no single impact. Even the great people that impacted singular that we hold up from Gandhi to Mother Teresa to Edison to Einstein, all of them, starting as early as Socrates, spoke about they had a dream team behind them. They had a network of people. Even though I might be the face of this movement, there's absolutely no way I could have done this without my partners, without a network of teachers, without everyone giving me at some level, not monetary support, but some kind of support to say, and mostly emotional support that says it doesn't matter if you get shot down 100 times. You go out there 101. These are kids' lives. So it doesn't matter if you're tired. It doesn't matter. Get your butt back out there and fight for this. This matters. It's worth fighting for. So,
love that. Well, that leads great into our next question. What is one piece of advice that you wish your current self could go back and give yourself when you were brand new to education?
Wow. That's a good one. That was a different hard question. That's a genius question.
Yes, I got one.
Yeah, all right.
I think this, because this is the advice that's hardest for me to live and the advice that I dispense to kids and other people, and that's own your genius. And it's so funny because I demand that of every single human being I'm at. I don't care if it's a CEO of a billion-dollar company or a five-year-old. Like, what is your genius? How did you know? When did you know it? And then kids have been the smart ones, and they've turned the question on me. They're like, okay, what's your genius, Mrs. Meyer? Crap, you're not supposed to ask me that. I'm like, oh, my God, I don't know. So I did figure out that my genius is liberating other people's genius. So I do know that that is it. But I think teaching kids and teaching grown-ups to own their genius early and to understand how critical it is, and in the business world we call that personal branding, and in the world of where we live, we call that, you know, coming into your own or whatever it is. Because the sooner that we can do that with self-awareness, with insight and integrity and humility, that you are not, and these fifth graders a couple weeks ago asked the most brilliant question. They said, we've been doing so good and we are so good at labeling other people's genius. We don't want to tell our class what our genius is because we don't want them to feel bad that we're bragging. And we positioned it as you're doing a disservice to the room. You're doing a disservice to others by not letting them know out front and up front what they can count on from you. Because the role is everyone contributes. But if you don't know what everyone has to uniquely contribute, you cannot go after the problems as fierce. So withholding your genius, I think especially for teachers who are very humble and want to give the credit to other people, it's seen as bragging. It's seen like, well, I did this and I did this. Well, I need to know what you did. I need to know who you are. I don't care what your grade is. I don't care what your file cabinet looks like. I don't care what your perfect score on SAT. I need to know who you are so when I encounter a problem or a challenge, I can come to you, Todd, and say, Todd is exactly the person we need for this. And there's nothing arrogant about it. It's a necessity, and I think it's a really difficult journey to figure out what your story is, and from the perspective of not just articulating what it is now, but articulating who you wish to be and living up to and into that. Right. And that's really what I do on the web every day. It's very weird still to see me put in categories like, you know, change agent and leader. Even the word leader is still strange for me. And so you make a decision that if you're being called upon to take this role in your community, you have a responsibility to live up to and into that with absolute humility and not one sense of arrogance, because you are called upon and are essential, and your community is telling you that. So I think my advice would be hard. Own your genius, own it early, and live into and up to that in service of other people.
You know, and I love that you say that, because, like I said earlier, I think as educators, we are the most resistant to that.
Right.
Because you look at the corporate world, and there's so many people often that own their genius and that do
right.
that. And then the education, we all kind of hide behind different things or feel like,
right.
oh, well, I can't say that. That's bragging. I don't want to hurt
right.
their feelings, stuff like that. But, I mean, it is powerful when you speak out and when you stand up and own what you do. Because I know, I mean, even for me, becoming a connected educator
yes.
and beginning to blog and share
yes.
some of what I'm doing, it does hold you accountable.
Totally.
And when you put something out there and right. you say something, you like, I got to stick with that. I got to follow that up. I got to, because that's now out there for everybody
right.
and it empowers you to keep going.
That's right. Your service is your brand. Even what you did with this, the process that you went through just to brand what you guys are doing with your company or your mission right now, is you're doing exactly what individuals have to do. You said there's great stuff in the marketplace. So I'm not trying to be better than what's already there. We already are providing a service by giving podcasts. So what is it that we can add flavor to of what's already there? How can we differentiate ourselves and provide another service, not as competition, but as an augmentation to what's there? And that's what you did, and you did that openly, and you did it authentically, and you keep doing this and being real, and you'll be amazingly successful. You have to do that as an individual as well. And the moment you, and I think there's just a, it goes back to the habitudes, there's a big mindset difference between organizations that have entrepreneurial expectations that are where innovation is expected, and organizations where standardization and conformity are celebrated. Even though we say they're not, they're absolutely celebrated. We do not have environments that are innovative because we treat innovation as an event or a project.
Mm-hmm.
So every single person in a startup or in an entrepreneurial company, even like Google, recognizes that any second they're replaceable. Their only job security is to be absolutely irreplaceable and to showcase how you're irreplaceable, how you will continually provide value and service to other people in a way that trumps who you're competing with. We don't see that because there's no competition, if you will, for our job. Once you have it, unless you do something really, really bad.
Right.
So no need to say at a massive level, there's not that overall cultural mindset that we are in a service industry, that our job is to service kids. And you're in a service industry, your number one use of social media is listening to the needs and wishes and wants of your clients. Every single minute, every single day, that is where all the money, all the research, all the development is. We know how our kids feel. We know what they're saying. We know how disappointed many of our clients are, and we just keep going forward without one. You could not do that in any other field except,
right.
except government, and education is a part of government.
Yes, it is.
No.
You do a great job on replying to everyone who writes to you, and I mean, you just, it seems like every day you just have hundreds of tweet backs to people, and you do a really great job with that. So we've got one more question here. It's is there any moment that you've had in your career that you'll kind of never forget? Maybe it was something that you were so emotionally impacted by, and it's just kind of going to stick with you.
Well, it was that moment I described at the very beginning where I felt this amazing freedom where, even though in working those four jobs all with children every day and feeling significant and feeling like I found my, I mean, I didn't even record time. The time that I spent with children and the time that I spent with these families in my job, I never saw it as a job. It was just seamless. It was that flow. And I'm doing what I was meant to do. And when I went home to tell my family, like, this was such an aha moment for me to recognize that never once did I visualize who I would be as a doctor or wonder or get excited. I never even actually thought about being a doctor. I just was passionate about medicine, and I just figured some job would come up and I'd research or whatever, but I was alive, absolutely alive, when I was working directly with families and kids. And I thought my family would be so excited for me, and not one single human being in my life, not my boyfriend, not my parents, not my aunts and uncles, not most of my professors except for one, said, they didn't not only say it was not a good idea, they were adamantly against it. Like, you are crazy, you are out of your mind, you're wasting your talent, what are you doing, you're going to be just a teacher and all of this. And it was at that moment that I really understood the habitudes. Like, it doesn't matter what anybody else thinks. I, asking me to not move forward and to not pursue this work that I was meant to do under all odds, it was the first time I understood what it meant to fight for something when no one else agreed, to take a risk when everybody else thought it was a failure. People that you respected, people that you loved, people that knew they had the best interest out for you, not any person directed me in this field. And it was when I really owned my genius. And I said, I can't not do this. I'm going to do this. I'm going to be a teacher. I don't care if I have to go back to college another year and a half. I don't care if I make a hundredth of whatever. I'm going to live a life knowing that I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. And I think that's significant. Emotional.
Awesome. We really appreciate you, you know, coming on today and talking about passions. We know you love passions, and we love passions too. And it's just so fun to talk to someone that's as passionate as you are. And I think this is the longest podcast we've had, Todd. That's good. No, it's awesome.
No, I was going to say this.
Start with my answers is not a genius of mine.
Well, I was going to say, you know, this, I have really enjoyed getting to talk with you on more than 140 characters, because, I mean, this is the kind of stuff that gets me beyond excited to start school here in the next week or two. I'm like, I want to go back to school now and start taking some of these ideas now and working with the kids and doing this stuff. So,
doesn't it make you just want to be with kids like tomorrow?
Exactly, exactly.
And kids get this. Like, that's what's so awesome is, like, teachers don't always get me, but kids always get me. So I'm like, I feel like stressed out, just like with kids, and they'll, like, say, yeah, you are crazy, or they're like, okay, we get that.
So, Angela, where can we find you on the web, and where do you blog at and tweet at and all those good things?
So you can, the easiest is just to Google Angela Myers. You don't even have to spell it right. It'll get to my stuff. That'll get to it. So I have a regular blog on a leadership blog called Switch and Shift, and I have a blog on Huffington Post, and then my personal blog is AngelaMyers.com, and it gets to all that stuff. So I'm in I'm in every space. So whatever your way of connecting is. So I've got LinkedIn and Google Plus, and my favorite place though is Twitter, as you know.
Sure. We really appreciate you coming on. Just a couple of ways that you guys can connect with us. We tweet at EduAllStarsHQ on Twitter, and also tweet under the hashtag EduAllStars. Our blog can be found at EduAllStars.com. We'll put all the show notes there from this and previous episodes. And then you can search us out on iTunes at EduAllStars under the podcast category. We're also in the K-12 category on the podcast, but you can find us there. And Todd?
And we have lots of really amazing guests coming up. We've had some incredible people on lately, and I'm really excited about our interview again next week that we have with the two guys and some iPads, Brad Wade and Drew Minock, who are going to come on and make a little bit of an announcement of their own. So we're excited they're debuting that on our show and showing us some really cool things and things they're passionate about within their classrooms and education right now.
And just lastly, if you made it this far, we just really encourage you to go leave some feedback on iTunes. It really helps out in the rankings, and it helps people, you know, get to hear the podcast that may not have seen it otherwise. So we really appreciate it if you would do that for us. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.
Yes, thank you, guys. Thank you.